Hi, I'm Sean Starr. This is number 0143, the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, and it comes to you right now.
The following program is brought to you in living color.
Now, it's time for an eclectic mix of interviews and some of the oddest news stories you'll ever hear. It's the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder.
Hey there, hi there, ho there. Peter Anthony Holder here with you, and yes, this is indeed another edition of the Stuff File program, number 0143. And coming up on this edition of the Stuff File program, Carol Brody Fleet, who is the author of Widows Wear Stilettos, has a new book out called Happily Even After. Carol talks about how to turn your life around after suffering the tragedy of becoming a young widow. How do the two books differ?
The first book is really an overall overview roadmap, and it's written from one perspective, and that is my perspective as a chronologically younger widow. The second book, Happily Even After, it's unique to the marketplace because it is a question and answer reference guide, and the questions are taken from actual letters written to me through widowswearstilettos.com over a period of almost 6 years.
Lauren Fash is the director of the short film Quiet, inspired by a true story of a lesbian who was denied access to her hospitalized partner because they were not legally married.
The film is inspired by a woman named Janice Langdon, a friend of a friend of a friend who knew Janice. I gave her my contact information and she called me. And this was literally 3 days before we started filming. So I sat down on the phone with her and we chatted for about an hour and a half. She went through her story. She still remembers every detail very vividly. So I was heartbroken and outraged and very inspired by her story.
Stuart Nallman is back with another edition of Book Banter.
Hi, I'm Stuart Nallman, and in this edition of Book Banter, Gary Marshall tells us how he put together Happy Days, Laverne and Shirley, and Mork and Mindy in his new memoir, My Happy Days in Hollywood, along with a couple of other memorable books by former TV bigwigs. So don't adjust your set. It's coming up later on the Stuff File program.
And we have lots and lots and lots of stuff. Plus, an idiot of the day. The guest Slater, the person who told you this was show number 0143, was Sean Starr, co-host of The Morning Show on Montreal's TSN Radio 990. And you can check out their website. You'll find the link on the Stuff File page for this program, which, as Sean mentioned, was number 0143. Thank you very much, Sean, for doing the slate on this edition of the Stuff File program. The Stuff File also heard on Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio. Let's get right to the stuff, shall we? Well, a new bra has been unveiled in Japan, and it is literally the coolest bra in the world. Designed to beat the intense summer heat, Triumph's new super cool bra features gel pads, which are placed in the freezer for up to 2 hours before wearing. Along with keeping you nice and cool, the bra is also adorned with a sprig of mint and a miniature wind chime to offer a refreshing fragrance and sound. Because the one thing the world needs is a noisy bra. Both bra cups have even been designed to look like fish bowls, with the gel packs in blue slip behind a fish and seaweed pattern. The bra was created to encourage Japanese citizens to cut down on air conditioning as the country continues to face a number of energy issues following the Fukushima nuclear power disaster in March of last year. Now, you know, I have a neighbor who has annoying wind charms, and now I'm going to have a new image in my head when I hear them at night. Yikes. Anyway, how low can you go? If you're 27-year-old Jamie Lynn Toller of Phoenix, it's pretty darn low. Police reports filed in Maricopa County Superior Court say Miss Toller told her former boss she needed a double mastectomy and breast reconstruction and was uninsured. She also told the same tale to her mother and her grandparents. We say tale because that's just what it was, a fairy tale, a bold-faced lie. Authorities say Toller then helped organize fundraisers and collected more than $8,000. However, medical records obtained by Mesa police show she didn't have cancer and in fact paid a plastic surgeon for a boob job with the cash. So she was arrested and now faces all manner of fraud charges. Wow, a woman gets a boob job, but in reality, she's just a boob. And cyclists who are tired of always being disregarded by rude drivers can now make sure that they're noticed with a new bicycle horn that's louder than the Concorde. No kidding. The Hornster bicycle horn emits a whopping 178 decibels, a level of sound so powerful that if used in anger, it could deafen any motorist who veered too close. It was developed by Britain's Environmental Transportation Association, or ETA, to highlight the dangers that cyclists face on city roads. The triple air horn is the same type used on American locomotives, but adapted to run off a scuba diving air tank. It is so powerful that at a distance of 100 feet, it is far louder than a standard semi-truck horn. The downside? It costs $7,000. But they'll definitely know you're coming. Now, what I want to know is, over time, how deaf will the aggressive bike rider be? That's what I want to know. And finally, in this section of Stuff File News with me, Peter Anthony Holder, before we get to our first guest on the program. Just 3 weeks ago on the show, I told you about a woman in Germany who kept a man prisoner demanding sex. Well, apparently she's been at it again. A man was found sobbing in the street by police after a one-night stand demanded too much sex. The African man broke down in tears outside the woman's apartment after a 36-hour ordeal in Munich. Police confirm that the exhausted man told them, "I met her on a bus. She invited me back here. Oh God, it was hell. I can't walk. Please help me." The man is believed to be the latest victim of a German nymphomaniac who was arrested last month after forcing her date to make love to her 8 times. Her first victim was forced to escape the apartment to raise the alarm after his insatiable lover refused to let him go. The 43-year-old met the woman at a bar in Munich. The pair then went back to her apartment where they had sex several times, but when the eager woman demanded more, the exhausted man refused. When the sex-hungry woman wouldn't take no for an answer, the man took drastic action. The desperate man was reportedly spotted on a balcony crying for help. A police spokesman was quoted as saying, "He complied with the woman's wishes another few times so that he could finally leave the apartment. But when she continued to refuse and demanded even more sex from him, he fled to the balcony and alerted the police." The victim reportedly told police, "You've got to help me. She's trying to kill me with sex. I cannot get out and I cannot go on." Incredibly, when police arrived at the apartment, the woman even tried to tempt them into her bedroom. The woman, who is believed to be 47, has now been taken to hospital for psychiatric observation. Heaven help the male hospital staff. That's all I'm saying. Anyway, let's get to our first guest here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. Carol Brody Fleet is an award-winning author, grief recovery expert, and speaker. Her first book was Widows Wear Stilettos. Her new book is Happily Even After, A Guide to Getting Through and Beyond the Grief of Widowhood. Carol is on the line with us right now from California. Hi, Carol.
Hi, Peter.
Nice to have a chance to talk to you again. We spoke on our old radio show when your first book came out a few years ago. So how have things been since then?
Things have been absolutely incredible. What started out as one book turned into a movement. And we are going and growing. And I know it sounds silly to be happy about a widow organization growing, because if people are part of us, obviously it's a terrible time they're going through. But the great news is that they have discovered support and education and community, which is so vital when you're going through spousal loss.
In going through this, because like I said, we spoke to you last time when the first book came out. Now you've done this for a while and you get to hear the feedback of people who have been touched by your book. In going through this, do you find a commonality, or was there any surprises into how some people deal with this situation?
I was surprised. I was very quickly humbled. You know, I think that one of the greatest things that anybody can do is be in service to others, because one of the things that it does is it compels you to get outside of your own dynamic. And you, when you start feeling so terrible for the situation you're in, and then you read some of these letters, and you get humbled very quickly as to what women and men of all walks go through when they lose the person that they expected to spend the rest of their lives with. And to read these letters of heartbreak and to hopefully be able to hold up a beacon of hope for so many, it's a phenomenal mission to be on.
I hate to say it, but it's almost like that saying, misery likes company.
Well, you know, I understand why you hate to say it, and I hate to hear it, because obviously we're not about misery. Misery is obviously what brings people to us. But what we want to do, and hopefully what we are accomplishing, is recognizing that grief can and should be acknowledged and dealt with, but you're not meant to live in a place of pain and sorrow. That's not why you're here. And hopefully we are providing the tools to help people through the pain of grief into the new life that they've been handed.
I love the title of the new book. It's not Happily Ever After, it's Happily Even After. How does this book differ from the first one, Widows Wear Stilettos?
Well, the first book is really an overall overview roadmap, and it's written from one perspective, and that is my perspective as a chronologically younger widow. The second book, Happily Even After, it's unique to the marketplace, Peter, because it is a question and answer reference guide, and the questions are taken from actual letters written to me through widowswearstilettos.com over a period of almost 6 years. And there's no other book like this in the marketplace, that you have real people asking real questions that are dealing with real situations and scenarios, and then I give my actual answers that I provided to many of these letters, along with additional commentary. So any scenario that you can imagine a widow might have, from the emotional to the practical, children, finances, dating, love, I found out my husband died from his mistress. I mean, there are some questions in there you can't even begin to imagine. But whatever's in there is written by widows, and it's answered by someone who's been there.
Have you found there's a difference or a change in how people accept or deal with either widowhood, if it's themselves, or with widows? And the reason why I ask that question, we live in a different time from, say, 30, 40 years ago. Have you heard, for instance, from some younger widows who were widowed many years ago? And is their situation different than yours?
Absolutely. We've got widows that are as young as 17 years of age, and we have widows up into their late 80s. We started out talking about issues that are particular to the chronologically younger widow. But we also heard from an enormous amount of baby boomers, which is really our largest group within Widows Wear Stilettos, is the baby boomer generation saying, well, am I young? Well, yeah, of course you are. And I say that because I'm a baby boomer. But let's go back to 1995. You have Oklahoma City. You have the tragedy that was September 11th. You have two United States-involved wars. That's an awful lot in 17 years. That's a lot of widowhood. And that's just the big newsworthy stuff. That's not the stuff like my situation, where my husband got sick and he struggled and he passed away. You've got all of that going on as well. So the demographic has expanded dramatically. The number of widowed are increasing because we are living longer. That is a byproduct of that. And we are hearing from people who have been widowed for 2 weeks and people who have been widowed for 20 years and more.
The reason why I asked the question about talking to older women who have been widowed, and I'm talking about older women who have been widowed when they were young, mm-hmm. and the difference that they might have gone through when they became widows oh so many years ago, is there used to be a time when they seemed to divide widows between two groups. You know, the merry widow, the person who seemed to get along almost too well, mm-hmm. and the person who never left her shell, and they never seemed to be anything in between.
Well, I think that the chief difference between somebody that was widowed, say, 30, 40 years ago as a younger woman versus now, is that younger women today, most women today, are in the workforce in one respect or another. You go back to the 50s, the 60s, and so forth, you've got women who were chiefly in the home. They were working in the home. So they really did not have as many choices and as many avenues as women today have. On the other hand, women today are being forced to go back to work early when they've barely started their grief process. So it is a very interesting paradigm shift. And it has a lot to do with what's happened with women in the workplace today.
Even though your website is widowswearstilettos.com, do you hear from widowers?
Absolutely. The first question I usually get is, why are you leaving us out? And we talked about this in the first show. I don't intentionally write to leave anybody out, but I would feel very presumptuous and almost insulting to look at a man and say, I get how you feel, because I don't. I'm not hardwired like a man. I'm not sure if you know this, Peter, but there's a difference between men and women. And, you know, women and men react to grief, trauma, challenge, celebrations, whatever, differently. And I felt that I would be insulting widowers if I said, yeah, I understand exactly where you're at, because I don't. It is different for a man. And sadly, there's even less support for widowers out there than there is for widows. And all of that said, we are happy to boast several hundred widowers in our membership.
When you know, there are people who do move on, there are people who do date and get married. Mm-hmm. Do you hear stories from those folks as well? In other words, you know, I'm sure this is not a situation where it's a support group for widows, and then once they move on, it's you don't hear from them anymore. It's part of who they are, even if they do move on. Correct?
That's absolutely correct, and I am one of those widows. I happily remarried in 2009 to an absolutely wonderful man who's actually executive vice president of the organization and really makes me look good. But the thing is, we refer to that as being a remarried widow. You don't leave that experience behind you. You move forward from it, but it's always a part of you. And I don't, you know, rub my happily even after in somebody's face, because I always have to remember what it was like to be what I call the two-week widow who couldn't even get off of a couch. But again, it's about being a beacon of hope, and hopefully somebody who is the two-week widow or the two-year widow can look at a remarried widow and say, wow, she did it. She was just like me, and she did it. And that means that I can do it too. All I have to do is learn how.
I'm sure there are those who have a difficulty getting past their grief, and therefore they find it hard to move on. But there's also another group of people, I'm sure, who don't want to move on because they're afraid of history repeating itself.
And that's a totally normal fear. I live with that fear, absolutely, because the widowhood journey, not one that I recommend. But it occurred to me, and it was almost an epiphany, it occurred to me that I could spend my life being afraid of losing again. And while I was being afraid, I was going to miss out on something really great. So as afraid as I am of losing, and I am, I'm more afraid of not living the life that I get to live now. You see? So I don't want to miss out on this, and I'm willing to roll the dice on the very, you know, the very real possibility that, you know, it's a 50-50 shot that I'm going to go through that experience again. But look what I would have been missing out on if I just stayed in that place of fear.
I'm sure you get to talk about all the issues that people go through under these circumstances, especially if they get a chance to find love again and perhaps remarry. For instance, such things as old photos.
Mm-hmm. That is a big issue. What I try and do, and I always frame it as, you know, this is what I did, this is what worked for me. You need to picture yourself as that other spouse coming into your home. And if they walk in and they see a shrine devoted to your late beloved, that's a little intimidating. And you have to ask yourself, what am I asking and expecting of this other person realistically? We, in our house, we have very subtle nods to Mike's memory, and we should, because he was obviously an enormous part of our lives and always will be. But now is a different time. It's a different life. It's a new life. And I want to live that life with the man that I love, who for some reason loves me back. And I don't want him to feel like he has to live up to Ghost of Husband Past.
The book is called Happily Even After. It's written by Carol Brody Fleet. And as I mentioned earlier, there's the website, widowswearstilettos.com, and also the blog, widowswearstilettos.blogspot.com. I thank you very, very much, Carol, for taking the time to be on the program with us.
Well, thank you, Peter. It is wonderful to be back with you.
Carol Brody Fleet, author of Happily Even After, A Guide to Getting Through and Beyond the Grief of Widowhood. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, go to the What's On page for this show, which is show number 0143, and you'll find links to Carol's website and also to her blog. You'll also find links to Amazon.com and Amazon.ca, where you can order her book directly.
You're listening to The Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. Drop Peter a line. He'd love to hear from you. You can email him at peter@thestufffile.com or catch up with him on Twitter or Facebook. There's more Stuff File coming your way in just a few moments.
Kelly Alexander Show is your place to be for everything to do with health, lifestyle, and entertainment. Join us as we chat with celebrities like Emmy winner Mia Michaels from So You Think You Can Dance, best-selling recording artist Taylor Dane, and world-renowned astronaut Julie Payette. We also cover important topics like breast cancer awareness and how to help your child through bullying. All this and more, please join us, www.kellyalexandershow.com.
It's The Kelly Alexander Show.
Capture your need for sound.
Peter Anthony Holder here. Have you ever noticed on some of those public broadcasting pledge drives, they tend to sound like ransom demands in a kidnapping?
Hey. Your kids like this, Mr. Rogers. It would be most unfortune if, for some unforeseen reason, you weren't in the neighborhood no more.
Well, I'm here to ask for your support in a non-threatening, non-obligatory kind of way. Part of the success of The Stuff File depends on the generosity of its listeners worldwide. So if you can, and if you want, please feel free to make a small one-time donation. Just go to the website at thestufffile.com and click on the PayPal donation button. You can donate $10, $5, or even $1, whatever you'd like.
You know that big bird? That would be one huge drumstick, if you know what I mean.
If you have a PayPal account, it's an easy transfer. And if you don't, all major credit cards are accepted. Your generosity would be much appreciated in keeping this show running.
About that antique roadshow, they might be seeing a little more concrete than they originally anticipated.
No strong-arm tactics, no ransom demands. Just a simple please and thank you. To donate, visit thestufffile.com.
Coming to you from the outskirts of sanity, this is The Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder.
And still to come on the program, we'll talk to the director of the short film, Quiet. Plus, we have another edition of Book Banter with Stuart Nolman. And, of course, there is an Idiot of the Day and lots more Stuff File news here on The Stuff File program. By the way, got Stitcher? We are on it, so get it. Stitcher is an award-winning provider of news and talk radio for your mobile phone. Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio. Let's get right back to the Stuff File news, shall we? More insanity from public schools that refuse to implement anything that resembles common sense. By now, you've probably heard about 6-year-old Devontae Meadows, a first grader at Sable Elementary School in Aurora, Colorado, who was suspended for 3 days after school officials said he told a girl, "I'm sexy and I know it." A line from the hit song by LMFAO. Somehow, this was considered sexual harassment by school officials who refused to discuss the case, except to say that sexual harassment has no age limit. The Aurora Police Department said it was not involved in the case because laws only cover children ages 10 and older. Devontae's mother, Stephanie Meadows, said her son doesn't even know the meaning of sexual harassment, adding, "I'm just floored. They're going to look at him like he's a pervert. That's not fair to him." Denver attorney Craig Silverman said school policies should allow for exceptions, noting, "Sometimes when you go to a zero-tolerance policy, you end up with a zero-sense policy." Wow, I couldn't have said that better myself if I tried. You know, I've heard this story debated all over television since it first came out, and everyone talks about how this 6-year-old wasn't even aware of what he said. I haven't heard anything about the girl that he sang it to. I'm assuming that she also doesn't have an idea of what the meaning of the line is. If the so-called offended party isn't capable of even comprehending the terminology, is there even a case here? That's all I want to know. Anyway, South Carolina still likes flying the Confederate flag on top of the State House, and its senators don't think twice about heckling presidents during State of the Union addresses, but I digress. But even they draw the line at truck nuts. Yes, for the second time in a year, a motorist has been ticketed in South Carolina for displaying a replica of testicles on a vehicle. A Spartanburg County Sheriff's deputy stopped a truck after noticing the anatomically correct display on the rear bumper. The driver removed the display after being stopped, but was then arrested for driving without a license. He was also given a warning ticket for having an obscene display. Last July, a Berkeley County woman was ticketed for having a similar display on the back of her truck. That case is going to go to trial in municipal court under a freedom of speech defense. Well, some states have different priorities than others, I guess. Anyway, not convinced the U.S. has some serious political polarization issues? In Chippewa Falls, Wisconsin, 36-year-old Jeffrey Rattle repeatedly tried to block his estranged wife from driving to the polls, explaining she was planning on voting for a certain candidate, and it wasn't the candidate he wanted her to vote for. So when Amanda Rattle, age 30, attempted to pull out, Jeffrey stood in her way in front of her SUV. Police say she nudged him with the vehicle several times, but each time he would retreat and reestablish his ground. When she finally attempted to drive around him, Jeffrey jumped in front of the vehicle and was hit. Jeffrey was hospitalized with head, neck, and back injuries. Jeffrey's brother, Mike Rattle, says, "These crazy liberal nuts are always pulling this crap." Really? He says his brother was in stable condition but had suffered serious injuries and was still unconscious later that afternoon. Chippewa Falls Police Chief Wendy L. Stelter said until this, the worst Election Day dispute she'd ever seen was a damaged yard sign. Police are still investigating, but so far no charges have been pressed against Amanda. Well, the idiot did jump in front of her SUV, after all. Anyway. Now, what's missing in this story, but what I'd like to know, is since Jeffrey was hit and was taken to hospital and remained unconscious for most of the day, does this mean that he didn't get a chance to vote? Tee-hee. Anyway, one more story before we get to our next guest here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. You think American politics is dirty after that last story? Well, Hans Ulrich Rudel, a Swiss politician and convicted murderer, is now accused of putting out an ad to attract potential cannibals interested in eating his friend's wife and 12-year-old daughter. Rudel, who co-founded the Embrachtetal branch of the Conservative Party, is accused of putting the ad out in 2010 in an effort to get his friend's wife out of the way during an ugly divorce. The ad said the mother and daughter were, quote, keen to meet gentlemen interested in slaughter and dolce who would like to roast us on a spit, unquote. And dolce, as Rudel allegedly told police, was his word for cannibalism. Unfortunately for Mr. Rudel, the response he replied to turned out to be an undercover police officer. Now, setting aside the fact that he's trolling for cannibals, isn't it just dumb for a politician to put any kind of ad out there looking for a killer, never mind an eater? I almost made him idiot of the day, but I didn't. That comes later. Anyway, let's get to our next guest here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. Director Lauren Fash's short film, Quiet, is making big noise at film festivals across the U.S. and also across the pond in England. The rip-from-the-headlines plot is inspired by a true story of a lesbian who was denied access to her hospitalized partner because they were not legally married. Lauren Fash is on the line with us right now from L.A. Hi, Lauren.
Hi, how are you?
I'm fine. Thanks for being on the program with us. So tell us about the genesis of getting this film made.
I was actually still in film school when this idea was pitched to me by my writing and producing partner, Susan Graham. And we decided, you know, we knew that it needed to be a feature. It was too big of a story to really be self-contained, but we knew going in that we needed to prove to people what we could do as filmmakers and, you know, show the potential of the story. So we decided to do a short film to kind of showcase all of these elements. So that was the first step. So we started that in December 2010. We kind of got everything together. And then we did a Kickstarter campaign during pre-production and begged and cried to all of our family members and started production in June and then wrapped the film in November. So it was about a year to get it done.
Now, as I mentioned, it was a rip from the headline situation. It is a true story. Did you get an opportunity to talk to the real people involved?
I did. The film is inspired by a woman named Janice Langdon. As you said, she was denied the right to say goodbye to her partner of 18 years in Florida in 2007. So when we did the Kickstarter campaign, a friend of a friend of a friend who knew Janice actually gave her my contact information, and she called me. And this was literally 3 days before we started filming. So I sat down on the phone with her, and we chatted for about an hour and a half. She went through her story. You know, she still remembers every detail very vividly. So I was heartbroken and outraged and, you know, very inspired by her story. So once the film wrapped, we continued to stay in touch. And I actually just recently flew to Washington with my co-writer and co-producer, Susan Graham. We flew to see Janice and show her the film at her home in Olympia. And she was definitely, you know, I think she connected to the film, and it upset her, but she was happy to see that her wife's legacy was living on, and she's definitely 100% supportive, and we are really excited to be able to tell her story.
Now, obviously, you plan this out when you make a movie. You do your storyboards, you work on a script, you figure out what you're going to shoot, but you say 3 days before you started doing the movie, you got in contact with Janice. Did talking to her just before you start the film affect the production in any way?
Oh, 100%. I mean, I don't want to say I felt an obligation, but I really felt even more passionate about telling the story and making the film not, you know, as accurate to her story because it's loosely inspired, but just bringing out the elements of what she felt and what happened to her, you know, the tragedy of what happened to her. And interestingly enough, when she told me her story, she specifically quoted the social worker who came up to her when she was at the hospital. As soon as she walked in, a social worker walked up to her and said, "Listen, you're in an anti-gay city and state. You don't have any rights here. And unless you show me this, this, and this, you're not going to get to see your partner." And I actually tried to put that in the film. I wanted to take that line because it was literally what was said to her. And we had a rehearsal with the actors, and we had to take it out because it was just, it seemed too over the top. I was like, I don't even think people will believe this. You know, it just seemed so heavy-handed. I mean, I literally couldn't even put it in the film. So, you know, it was interesting trying to pull from her story, definitely.
I mentioned that it's making some noise at film festivals and also in the UK. Have you been surprised by the reaction?
I have. You know, it's been very humbling. We just screened at the Newport Beach Film Festival, and everyone was so welcoming there and so excited to hear about the film. And I think that it's actually something that's on our side is the fact that it's got great timing. You know, Obama just today announced his support for same-sex marriage, and you know, we're in a time where change needs to happen, and I feel very lucky and privileged to be able to tell a story that is this important, and people need to know these things. And I think that, you know, a lot of people don't even realize that this is happening in the country. And if they did, they might think differently about gay marriage and the fact that it is necessary for equal rights. So, yeah, I feel really lucky.
Have you received any negative reaction to the film?
We haven't. You know, we haven't gotten any negative reaction. I feel like the people who watch this film, we wanted to make the movie for everyone. You know, it is politically charged. It definitely has, you know, a statement. But at the same time, at the heart of it, it's a love story. And I feel like a lot of people can relate to the film. You know, it's not geared just towards the gay community. It's geared towards everyone. So, you know, we haven't gotten any negative feedback. I'm sure that, you know, eventually someone will disagree and it'll happen. But we've been lucky. We haven't experienced that yet.
For a lot of filmmakers, particularly young filmmakers, making short films is sort of like a calling card, an opening of the door into the business of doing either longer documentaries or scripted films. How has this experience changed or altered you as a director, not just the process of making this film and making this story, but the process of also promoting a film like this?
You know, it's crazy to me how much I learned on this film, actually. I went to film school at USC, and I was there for 2.5 years, and it was an amazing program. I loved going to school there, and I learned a lot. But we had an 8-day shoot, and I learned more in those 8 days than I think I did in 2.5 years of film school, simply because of the fact that it was, you know, nonstop. And it was wonderful being able to work as a writer, a director, and a producer, because I got to feel out, you know, all of the elements. And it was an incredible experience, and definitely a learning one. And you know, when we first thought of the idea and we first decided we were going to do this film, we definitely knew we wanted to do the short film, but I think there was a lot of apprehension on my side because I didn't want to jump into something that I didn't feel I was ready for. And I questioned, I thought to myself, I hadn't done a feature before and I didn't want to rush into anything. But now, honestly, I feel very confident and I feel like, you know, 100% I'm ready, which is great.
Sometimes people take a short film, and if it has a success, they then redo it into feature length. Is that a possibility with Quiet?
100%, yes. We are in talks with a few people about the feature film, and it's definitely what I'm working on now and what I really think, you know, I believe in this story. I believe it needs to be told. And with a feature film, you have the possibility of distribution, so you get to, you know, show it worldwide. And yeah, that's definitely a possibility. Fingers crossed that will happen. We're hoping.
Tell us about the cast you used.
Well, the lead who plays Allie is my co-writing and co-producing partner, Susan Graham. Susan's incredible. I actually met her while I was still in film school. She auditioned for a project that I was doing for a directing class. And I remember at the audition, I was kind of like, what are you doing here? This is a student film. Why are you here? But she's very classically trained. She went to Yale, studied drama at Yale, and she's just incredibly smart and incredibly talented. And I feel really blessed to be able to work, you know, by her side. And she was actually the one who came to me with the idea. She said, you know, I've got this idea and I want you to think about it. And it just stuck, you know, in my head. And that's when she found the article about Janice. And that's when we really were just completely blown away. So that Susan plays Allie, and then Jacqueline Beetham, plays Sam. And Jacqueline's wonderful. She does classical, dancing and she came in for audition and everyone in the room was just kind of like, done. That's it. She's perfect. and then Mike Rose plays James, and kind of a funny story. I saw Mike Rose. He is also a writer-director as well as an actor. But I saw one of his films at Outfest last year, and I fell in love with it. It was one of the funniest things I've ever seen. And I kind of started to stalk him a little bit. Susan and I both did. We literally started looking up everything he'd ever done and finally just Facebooked him and said, I want to work with you, please. You know, we have this film. Would you mind coming in and taking a look at it? And he was thrilled, and he joined the cast, and he was amazing. I love working with him, and I am excited to work with him in the future as well. And then we had Bridget McManus, who is well-known in the lesbian community. She's a stand-up comic and an actress and a writer and kind of has all kinds of talent. And she's actually a friend of mine. Bridget and I met on a film called Wanted in 2007, so she just, I really wanted her to be a part of the project. And then we had Coco Brown plays Nurse Mel, who you'll see her on Tyler Perry's new sitcom. And she's doing really well for herself. And again, she was just another one that came into the audition and we were all blown away and said, please be in part of this project. And I don't want to forget anyone. We have Tom Lommel, who played Dr. Downey, who again, incredible actor. Caroline Bielskis, who plays Nurse Lucy, who was kind of the villain in the film, but in actuality, she's one of the loveliest women I've ever met. So that's an ode to her acting capabilities.
If you had the opportunity to make this into a feature film, would you use the same cast?
Well, the problem that we have now is the fact that the feature film is going to be a little bit different than the short film.
Right.
But, you know, I would be honored to work with this casting, and they're all incredible. And any way I can work with them, whether it's this project or in the future, I would love to.
Well, as I said, the movie is making some noise, and the film is called Quiet. People can check the website, which is www.quietthemovie.com. And Lauren, I thank you very, very much for taking the time to be on the program with us. Good luck with the film.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me on. I really appreciate it.
Director Lauren Fash. Her short film is called Quiet. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, go to the What's On page for this show, which is show number 0143, and you'll find links to the film's website. You're listening to The Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
I'm Bob DiRigo-Jones, and this is Let's Be Fair. Have you ever heard of synthetic marijuana? I never did until a couple of weeks ago. That was when a boy near my home bought some at a local store to get high. He then went on a bloody rampage that sadly ended with the death of his own father. This terrible product goes by the name of K2, Spice, and others, and many teens around the nation are buying it legally at gas stations and convenience stores. It's a huge threat to our young people and can cause wild, psychotic behavior, so lawmakers in many states are working right now to ban it. In my community, one mom took the initiative to make a website that lists the stores that sell K2, warning others of the dangers. This is a great way to help change the culture, just like Mothers Against Drunk Driving and others have done. Let's be fair, we're going to need more than new laws. We're going to need grassroots effort. It's better than lawsuits, and it's part of the American tradition of community action when tragedy strikes. So keep up the important work, and visit us at centerforamerica.org.
From our studios in Montreal, Canada, and going out to the rest of the world, this is the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. It's time to crack a spine. The Stuff File presents Book Banter with Stuart Nauman. Once again, here's Peter Anthony Holder.
And I'm Peter. He's Stuart. Hi, Stu.
Sunday, Monday, happy days. Tuesday, Wednesday, happy days. You want me to go Shlemiel Shemazel?
No, I'm always afraid how this segment starts because I get this fear that at some point you're going to break into song. And quite frankly, you're really disappointed.
Hey, you know, I got a repertoire here that just won't quit, let me tell you.
Apparently, yeah.
Well, in this edition of Book Banter, we're going to look at, well, the reason I hummed that little ditty, TV theme, is because we're going to talk about the man who created Happy Days, Gary Marshall. He's the famed Hollywood writer, producer, director. His personal and professional mission during his more than 50-year career in show business was basically to entertain people and make them laugh. It was a lesson in life that he got from his mother, who was herself a born entertainer. Now, Gary has managed to create an impressive series of hit TV sitcoms and movies, such as Happy Days, which I just sung, Laverne and Shirley, which I just uttered, and Mork and Mindy, and Pretty Woman, The Princess Diaries, Beaches, not to mention his impressive resume as a prolific TV and movie screenwriter, as well as countless on-screen appearances. I mean, remember him as network boss Stan Lansing on Murphy Brown?
Right.
You know, he's very talented, very diverse. Well, it's been an impressive career in which Marshall has enjoyed every minute of it. And he enjoys recalling his career with his recently published memoir, My Happy Days in Hollywood. He was born in New York City, in the borough of the Bronx in particular. And basically, after he finished a stint in the U.S. Army in Korea, he started writing for TV. He collaborated actually as a writing team with a Korean war buddy. And he contributed jokes for such top stand-up comics as Joey Bishop, Jack Parr, Jack Carden, and Phil Foster. And if you know Phil Foster, he was the actor, comedian who played Laverne's father in Laverne and Shirley. Now, by the early 60s, he began to write for The Tonight Show, The Lucy Show, The Danny Thomas Show, and The Dick Van Dyke Show, where at one time one of his scripts was greeted with by Mary Tyler Moore by being thrown at him directly. He was told that he shouldn't take that script in the head from Mary Tyler Moore personally. So as the 60s ended, Marshall teamed up with a new writing partner, Jerry Belson, and they were given a golden opportunity by ABC to produce the TV version of the hit Broadway comedy The Odd Couple. Now, although playwright Neil Simon publicly hated the show when it debuted in 1970, it became an immediate hit and ran for 5 seasons on ABC. Now, the book chronicles with very entertaining detail Marshall's story as a writer, producer, and director, and how he has used his Bronx-nurtured character to uniquely approach each sitcom and movie that he has worked on. In fact, each chapter is dedicated to each of his creations in chronological order. There's some very interesting facts and anecdotes, especially one of my favorites is how he always uses actor Hector Elizondo in all of his movies as a good luck charm. And he's a good character actor. He's a very talented actor as well. Now, one of my favorite chapters deals with his third successful sitcom, the Happy Days spinoff Laverne and Shirley, which ended up being the antithesis of his former show, of Happy Days. Because Marshall admits that it was literally happy set on Happy Days. However, in the case of Laverne and Shirley, it was the exact opposite. It was a rather toxic set with plenty of egos, attitude, fighting, arguing, cursing, and in fact, many writers dreaded working for the show, and the turnover rate amongst writers was quite high. And Marshall explains that one of the big problems of Laverne and Shirley was that Penny Marshall and Cindy Williams, who were relatively new to, you know, acting a hit sitcom, were too immature to handle the success and the fame that it brought along.
Even though one of them was his own sister.
Exactly. So he doesn't exactly play favorites. He's very honest, brutally honest about that. But My Happy Days in Hollywood is so enjoyable. It really echoes Gary Marshall's passion and enthusiasm of working in front of and behind the camera, and shows a hardworking man in a tough business who actually enjoys his job of going on TV or a movie set and creating something that will entertain and amuse as many people as possible. On behalf of the millions of people who have seen and enjoyed Marshall's impressive body of TV shows and movies, we can proudly say, mission accomplished.
Well, you know, you started off by talking about how happy he has been in enjoying his career, and you ended off by saying exactly the same thing. And all while you were talking about him, and you talk about his enjoyment of a very prolific and fruitful career, I kept thinking of another man who we both met.
Yeah.
Who seemed to relish and enjoy every single thing he did in an entirely lengthy career. And that was the late Sherwood Schwartz.
Oh, yes. And you know what? He has an impressive array of sitcoms as well. And yeah, he loved every minute of it. He's also full of terrific stories and anecdotes of how he put his hit shows together.
Yeah.
And he put out a couple of interesting books as well. In fact, a book, Brady, 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 about life with working on the Brady Bunch. And also Inside Gilligan's Island, which gives the inside story of how he put the pilot together on the same weekend that JFK was assassinated, and it all took place in Hawaii, actually.
Mm.
Yeah, and also, if you want a good book about another TV bigwig, it just came out just recently, Warren Littlefield, who was the model for Russell Dalrymple in Seinfeld, former NBC president, new book called Top of the Rock, which is a oral history of the must-see TV years on NBC, which he guided during the 80s and 90s.
Top of the Rock is a book I really wanted to get my hands on, and I noticed I actually took a look to see what it would cost picking it up on Kindle, because you know I love my Kindle.
Oh, yes, you do.
And I was surprised at the cost of that book on Kindle. So I'll just wait a little bit when the price comes down, because it was pretty pricey for a Kindle book. That's all I'm saying.
Or maybe you could spend the extra $3 and go back to the good old-fashioned paper version.
The Dead Tree as opposed to the E version? Yeah, I might just do that.
It's a thought.
Anyway, this week's book was?
It's called My Happy Days in Hollywood by Gary Marshall. It's published by Crown Archetype, and it's $29.95.
And if people want to find you, Mr. Stuart Nauman, how can they go about doing so?
Well, you can come and find me on paper at the West End Times, or if you want to go the e-route, go to www.westendtimes.ca.
Thank you very much, Stu.
You're welcome, Peter. Shlemiel Shemazel.
Stuart Nauman with another edition of Book Banter here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
The Stuff File.
And we're almost in the home stretch here on the Stuff File program. We have an idiot of the day coming up, but first, some more Stuff File news stories to get through. Somebody needs a new wingman. Police in South Carolina arrested Calvin Bernard Hill after the 54-year-old allegedly stabbed his friend during a disagreement over which man can have more sex, according to a Greenwood police report. Following a night of partying, Hill and his friend were riding in the backseat of a PT Cruiser when the argument began. The victim, a 32-year-old male whose name was redacted from the police documents, told authorities that he and Mr. Hill got into a verbal altercation about who is more capable with the ladies. That argument led to a tussling match and soon escalated to the alleged stabbing. "I've been stabbed," the victim yelled, according to Hill's cousin, who was driving the car. Hill then yelled, "I can't go down for this," and threw the knife into the bushes, the cousin added. The victim was bleeding profusely from a 1-inch wound when authorities found him. Hill initially denied the attack, telling police that the man stabbed himself, according to the report. Hill is charged with assault and battery. Well, who's having more sex is not a debate Calvin is going to want to continue in jail. And according to Michelle Mars and Ian Yeoman of Victoria University of Wellington, England, Human prostitutes could be a thing of the past as early as 2050 as lifelike robots become commonplace. Mars and Yeoman see lots of advantages in their predicted stark advances in robot technology, including having what these so-called hobots will do. These commercial sex robots would be free of disease and would reduce the trafficking of real people, said Mars. She added, "Society has had relationships with machines, and we continue to be increasingly intimate with our relationships with more and more sophisticated technologies." Christian Bryant of Mashable.com does see potential downsides, such as weird R2-D2 noises during sex and waiting for software updates. But, of course, there is one giant upside. Technically, this won't be cheating, right? Right? Anyway, yeah, somehow I don't see women agreeing with that last point. But there's also something else I'm sure the makers of these hobots will have to think about. Sure, they may be disease-free, but after each use, who gets to be the lucky person who has the job of cleaning them? Anyway, Stephen Egan, age 52, was on a hunting trip in Flagler County, Florida, when he spotted a wild hog outside the tent. He raised his .30-caliber rifle and fired, and then went out to track the beast down. Once outside, he took a second shot. There's only one problem. It wasn't a wild hog. He had, he told investigating sheriff's deputies, shot his girlfriend, Lisa Simmons, also 52, through both of her legs. Egan said he was unaware that Simmons had left the tent and was in the woods. Simmons was flown to a hospital for surgery and is expected to survive. So, 2 points here. First, it would be interesting to hear him attempt to explain to her just how he mistook her for a hog. And two, if he mistook his girlfriend for a hog and shot her not only once but twice, let's be honest, just how ugly is his girlfriend? Yeah, let's let that sink in for a moment. Anyway, we're almost done on the show, but we do have time for one more item, and that would be the idiot of the day.
And now it's time for the strange things adults do. The Stuff File presents the idiot of the day.
Ricardo Felix, age 31, of Phoenix, Arizona, was arrested on charges of grand theft auto and insurance fraud for allegedly falsely reporting his vehicle was stolen. According to the San Bernardino County, California Sheriff's Office, Felix had conspired to hide his vehicle at a family member's house, then reported it stolen. The plan worked until the anti-theft tracking system that Felix paid for as a special option was activated by police and notified officers where it was. Investigation then revealed the conspiracy, and Felix was arrested. According to a sheriff's spokesperson, Felix said he was unaware that the car was equipped with a tracking device. Well, looks like the car was smarter than the criminal, because why would you not be aware of an anti-theft tracking device that you paid for as a special option when you plan to have your car stolen and stashed? One reason and one reason only. You're an idiot!
Gee, I'm only a kid, but even I know you're an idiot.
And that's it for this edition of the Stuff File program number 0143. Hope you enjoyed it. The website is thestufffile.com, and once again, stuff is spelled S-T-U-P-H, where you'll find information and links on all of our guests by going to the Stuff File page. Just look for the corresponding program number, and once again, that's 0143. Email me at peter@thestufffile.com. You can also find me on Facebook and Twitter as PA Holder, and don't forget to check out the Stuff File store, where you can purchase a plethora of Stuff File merchandise, from t-shirts to mugs to tote bags to mouse pads. Hope to see you back here for our next show on the air, online, or as a download. We're coming to you from everywhere, including CyberStationUSA.com, KDXRadio.com, AirChecker, Canada's number one radio source, streaming on PCJ Media and its partner stations, TrueTalkRadio.com, downloaded on iTunes and Stitcher, and over the air on World FM in New Zealand, MediaCorp in Singapore, and WSTJ in St. Johnsbury, Vermont. That's it. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, a presentation of Flying Fish Communications. A tape of the preceding program will be sent to the Radio Hall of Fame, where it will be placed under the statue of Marconi, which is kind of wobbly.